Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 89 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So we're diverting a little bit from our normal schedule. We've had kind of a full week of things to do.
It's been a full month. My gosh.
I know. But this week especially, we just did not have time to round up our announcements, so we're just going to skip announcements this week and go straight to our episode discussion. This week, we are discussing episode 111, entitled The Devil's Mark, which I'm sure, I think another good thing about cutting the announcements this week is, as we all know, that this is Ginger's favorite sequence in the first book.
Yay, I feel like the word right. Not chapter, not part, sequence.
I feel like she will have a lot to say about this.
I think you're lying.
And I think that we don't even have time for announcements.
That's a reason to. Okay, so. You know, or you knew, I hope you knew, because at least had a thought, like I did, when the opening was, right, the little difference of da-da-da-da, sorry, no, that's Jamie and Claire theme, the tiny little bit of a...
It was like a string quartet.
Yes, of the intro.
Of the intro.
Of the opening music.
But it was like the quartet was all large stringed instruments. Like, it sounded like it was high and tinny, or, you know, it was ominous and big.
It was beautiful.
We have in our hometown there's an area near where we live that has a starling. What is that? What are they called? A murmuration of starlings, and they're creepy. It is the creepiest thing I think I've ever seen. I'm terrified when I see them because they move like one giant unit.
Yes.
They move, as Claire says, in a synchronized fashion, and they all stay together, and it just looks really creepy. It's like they're almost like poured metal. Like, they just kind of ebb and flow.
That's a good way to say it.
Oh, they're creepy. So when I saw that opening, I was like, ugh, put that with that music, and it's like Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, and they're creepy, and they're coming for you.
So on the opening, when we saw those birds flying over the loch, or the body of water, and that sky, and I froze it a few times, you know, and did like a screenshot. That sky was gorgeous. Did you see it? It was not just, oh, blue and white cloud. No, there was purple and light pink, and with the birds and that string music, to die for. Just, I mean, again, favorite sequence. Honestly, I have to say, as much as I love the wedding, and as much as I loved the basically Tobias and Claire show, excuse me, the BJR and Claire show in episode 106, The Garrison Commander, this, you might not have such a hard time to guess, my favorite episode so far. It's just too many things. Obviously, it's not identical to the book. We knew going in, it's not going to be. It's its own creation. But so much. Everything I'm partial to it anyway, it all worked for me.
Well, what I will say leading into this is that I have enjoyed every episode so far. This is the first episode that I got choked up.
Thank you. Holla.
Okay, stop that. The first episode where I was choking back a few tears. I thought,
did you just wink at me?
Not on purpose.
Okay.
Maybe it was a stroke.
Don't joke about that.
Point is this was the, I mean, and I've enjoyed every episode, and I've found things moving, but this was the first episode where I choked back a couple tears and wiped, had some wetness on my face. It wasn't full crying, but it was like my parenthood moment.
Oh, yeah.
Because I cry at every episode Summer of Parenthood.
Does, I mean, I've never really
it's
watched
over now,
you
I'm
watched
sad,
you.
But I did.
But you said you used to ugly cry at Parenthood.
Oh, God. I would like...
Even your face now. Oh, God.
Like, there was like moments where...
Like notebook crying?
Where I was silent scream crying. Like, I didn't want to like pouring down my face, no sound coming out, because if I let sound out, I would never be able to pull it back in.
Oh, my
It's like one of those moments where it's... You're fighting the tears because you know if you fully give into it, you're never going to stop.
And I, even though we've read difficult chapters and sad chapters in the in the first book and, you know, part of the second book, and for our read-along. And we've discussed difficult things and sad things, and we discussed all the episodes. And again, this is the first time I've gotten tears in, like, almost every episode of the show, but not because of the storyline necessarily per se. It was the effect of me on me as a reader coming into this with just, you know, so in love with the story, 15, 17 year reader, whatever, and just the expectation and like the holy crap, this is actually making it to screen. It was emotional for me just to see it. It wasn't necessarily emotional to me because, I mean, their performances are wonderful, but I agree with you. It was, I think, for me, the first time that I actually had tears because, not just because of, oh my gosh, we're actually seeing Outlander on TV, you know? Because the opening gets me every single week. I mean, just that, I still say it again, her running through all the bodies they show with no faces or no full face. It is so mysterious. We know who it is and we've seen that part, but I still get chills at the opening. That's all I'm trying to say. So I'm emotionally affected just by the fact that, hello, Outlander's on TV. I still can't believe it. I'm getting there. I'm on board. I'm on that train. But this was the first time that I was touched emotionally, not just because, oh my gosh, my favorite books are now on TV, but because, holy S-bomb, this is freaking wonderful, wonderful story writing. And before we get too much further, Ms. Tony Graffia, oh, I want to drop that S-bomb. Holy crap.
Yes. Fantastic job. But I did want to point out, you keep talking about the opening sequence. This week, yeah. I went to watch the episode.
And 35 different times. That's a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other podcast. But it started to play because I didn't know if it was going to work or not. It started to play and I went to go plug my headphones in because my daughter was awake and she's not allowed to watch the show with me. And the intro started. And so just the beginning of the theme song. And I went and plugged my headphones in, and my 6-year-old turned to me and she goes, "Oh, mommy, I want to hear the theme song." So I was like, "Okay." So I unplugged it so she could listen to it, and she goes, "Her voice is so pretty."
Oh, Rhea, you have a little 6-year-old fan. So, if we could get, I mean.
But then I almost felt challenged. I was like, "Oh, really? Maybe I need to sing this. Maybe I need to." You think her voice is pretty? Who am I? I didn't, but I let Rhea have it, but I thought about it.
Girl, you see her every day, and she looks up to you for everything. You can let Rhea have this one thing. Okay. Rhea and Bear. I think your ego will be just fine. But I hear you. I know what you mean. So,
where to start?
Oh my! I'm still on those starlings. Yeah. So the starlings come back a little bit later in the episode, of course. But just seeing the picture. And, of course, the stringed instruments. And I wrote down, you've already kind of mentioned it, but I wrote down, remember the birds, for later on. The episode opens in the thieves' hole.
No, it does not open in the thieves' hole. It opens as they're thrown into the thieves' hole.
Or dropped or something. Sorry. It opens as they enter the thieves' hole. However, right. That was dropped or jumped. Oh, they didn't jump.
Dude,
but
I mean,
pushed,
and you know,
whatever.
Like, okay, when it first opens, you can't tell how far they fall, but you're just like, ouch, dude, that's rough.
Yeah.
And knowing that Galus is pregnant, you know that Claire is pissed at Galus because she wasn't even remotely concerned for the fact that she was just thrown down a hole and probably landed horribly, which could have upset the pregnancy. And she just wanted nothing to do with it. She was just like, whatever. But I just thought, ouch, dude, that was kind of, that was a rough thing to do.
And it, again, sometimes depending on how you're watching it or what device you're watching it on, it's so difficult to see because it's so dark. This show is so dark. I mean, the lighting is, it's natural light, naturally lit, a lot of it, outside of the studio, obviously, in nature. It's beautiful. I don't think I've seen anything except for one of those nature shows or like those Disney follow the animals across the savannah kind of thing. I've never seen scripted television that is so beautiful. I don't think. I mean, yes, I'm partial. I know that. But it's also Scotland, which, again, I'm partial. I know that. But holy monkey balls. It is crazy beautiful. But anyway, it was a little bit hard to see. But I watched it a few times, so I was able to see. It reminded me of the... And I know you don't watch the show, but other Outlander fans who watch the show Helix, when they first shut that grate down on the thieves' hole, it reminded me, I had a little flashback to the episode when they threw, I can't remember the name, sorry, too many shows, but when they threw those two people down in that hole or prison or whatever it was, the jail cell that was underground or where, that also had like a grate on top, and I was like, oh, it looks like almost the same, I know it's not the same set, but it looked very similar.
Well, as a book reader, I've envisioned the thieves' hole over the years. And for whatever reason, I don't know why I never envisioned it being something that was just a hole in the ground they were dropped into. Like, I don't know if in my brain I thought it was like a cave or that there was a better way for them to get in and out of it. But I never envisioned them just being literally
dropped
or pushed into a hole into the ground with a very steep decline.
I don't know what I expected, but I will say what they showed was, I mean, because I didn't have an exact image in my mind, but dude, that could have been from my brain. Just what they showed. Again,
well, once it was there, amazing. Once they were, okay, inside, no, yes. Once they were in it, I thought it was way more lit than I imagined it would be.
Yeah.
From
even though it was pretty dark.
I know, but from reading the book, you got the impression that it was.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't see anything.
They couldn't see anything. Yeah. So they could see a significant amount more than I envisioned they would be able to. I think that the grate opening was clearly larger and let more light in than I envisioned.
Yeah.
Still, it was very picturesque. Like, it was a very picturesque hole in the ground they were in. I thought it was kind of beautiful,
almost
actually,
like an underground little grotto.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it looked very cold, so that would have sucked. But other than that,
it only had on 85 layers. I'm sure they were fine.
That were easily terrible later in the episode. Can we talk about that later?
Yes. And I'm like, terrible? Oh, you mean like
tear?
Something easily to
able
tear.
To be torn.
Got it. So once they're down in the pit, down in the thieves' hole, Claire confronts Galus about her poisoning her husband.
He's like,
how do we get down?
We're not even there yet. Can we just talk about how quickly she knew Leary wrote that note?
Oh, gosh.
I mean, yeah. Okay, I didn't get from the last look of her peering out of the, whatever, the wagon they were taking
Leary?
Away in.
Or Claire?
No. I understood that we as the audience saw Leary. I didn't know that she saw Leary from the back of that wagon. And that being said, the jump from her quickly stating, it's Leary's fault that I'm in here. She knew that she's the one who told them I was coming. She's the one who wrote that letter. I thought that was a real big jump. Like, that was, I mean, she already is clearly blaming her for so many other things from the last episode to this episode. So maybe it's not that far of a jump to have known that, but she should have thought of that before she actually left to go to Galus's house in the first place.
Oh, well, we said that 2 weeks ago, or I guess last week.
Last week.
All the weeks. Oh.
All the weeks.
So when they get in the thieves' hole, or fall, or are pushed, or however they get down there, and yes, and she talks about the note, and Claire confronts Galus about her poisoning her husband. And I thought, Galus's reply, there's like a beat.
A long beat.
She doesn't say anything, and then she goes kind of like,
I started with white arsenic.
No, before that, before she explains, she literally, I wrote down, hair flip. She literally tossed her hair, or if not with her hands, she went, with her neck. She turned around and like tossed her hair or flipped her hair. I'm like, Galus, seriously, this is not the time to like, dude, either tell her or don't tell her.
Well,
but
here's the thing.
I mean,
at that moment,
that made
she
me laugh.
She still thinks Dougal is coming for her.
We're going to get there, too.
And I want, and before we even
this
get there,
woman,
I want to say that this episode was the best acting by Lotte Verbeek. Like, this was the best. I mean, granted, it was the meatiest.
Yeah, exactly.
The meatiest stuff she was
given. She hasn't had a ton of stuff
but
yet.
But she, the range that she showed in this
Dude,
episode.
You're going to make me tear up already. I can't. You see her character remain strong among all this crap. Come to a realization that Shiz is getting real and she is not going to be rescued. That broke my freaking heart. We know it, but seeing it on her face, and I have pictures of it.
Oh my God, calm
stills.
Down.
Sorry.
Calm down.
Seeing it on her face.
Do you need to take a moment? You want to talk
about
something else?
Seeing it on her face broke my heart. And that's what she's supposed to do as an actress. You see it, and you see the tears come to her eyes. And then she, because she's Galus, and this is where I see book Galus coming through, which is freaking awesome. She's just a strong freaking woman. No matter what, she is a survivor. And even though she had that breakdown for a moment, you see her, like, her world shattered for a moment on her face.
Her world shattered so many times in this episode, and you could see it. There were so many moments where she literally, they would just, the camera would catch her, and she would just, part of her would just die a little bit in her face, and then they would, oh, I made her cry. Hang on. Okay. Part of her would just die for a minute, and then she literally, you could see her taking a beat and then going, F it, I've got to move on. But you could see it. It was this... If there was an episode in this show so far where you could clearly define that this was, like, Lotta's episode, this was it. She owned this episode, like, front to back. Or front to pyre. We'll call it that. Front to pyre.
Front to stake.
Steak? Okay. I thought you said stank at first.
But, I mean, we're going to get to those little mini breakdowns.
And the only thing I will say is that if... I know that... I've said this before. EW, so Entertainment Weekly, every week does
what
like...
What the hell is EW?
I know. Entertainment Weekly, every week has a quotes of the week where sound bites is what they call it, where they pull lines from episodes.
Oh my gosh.
If she does not make the sound bite, I'm not going to say the line. I'll say it later. But if she does not make that sound bite page for her... for a line in this episode, there is something wrong with Entertainment Weekly.
She not only showed her best, and yes, it was her meatiest thus far, so it makes sense that it would be her best. She not only owned this freaking episode, she had, honestly, I think the best line of any episode thus far.
And the ridiculous. Most convincing pregnancy belly on a naked person
ever. Oh, hello. Yeah. So we'll get there. Holy crap. Okay.
Okay. Back to where we were.
So, as I said, hair flip. So Galus opens up about poisoning Arthur. As you said, she explains kind of how she did it. Galus is convinced, and this is where you still see she is... I don't want to say off her rocker. She's not. She is... I think if Dougal were still around, he absolutely would come and get her. She's absolutely right about that. But she does not know what the heck's going on.
And she is, but...
But it
broke her a little bit to realize...
Of course it did.
That he
wouldn't put up a fight.
That as much as he, quote-unquote, cared for her and or loved her in his own way, his brother saying, get out of here, do not come back, was stronger than that.
Absolutely.
So as much, and he did. He did go to call him and say, "I want to marry her. She's pregnant with my child. I want to raise this. I want to be with her." And none of that mattered as soon as Colm said, "You'll leave."
Yeah.
And that was sad for me when you think of it from her point of view. And even though she herself as a character said, you know, because Claire was like, "I think I think based on what you said that you love him." You do love him. And she's like, you said that, not me.
Yeah.
So even she didn't want to admit that.
Yeah.
But she clearly thought that things were different than they actually were.
So Claire then has to tell her what actually happened. She tells her about Dougal and Jamie leaving, being ordered to leave. And then I wrote, they get cuddly. So it's time for bed, time to sleep, do what they can. And I think Gayla said...
They don't get cuddly.
Well,
she says...
Am I being facetious?
No, she's... First of all, okay, before they get cuddly, they throw down here's dinner.
They cuddly?
They throw down dinner. And they throw down this half loaf of bread that looks like...
Still for 5 days,
And they're like, here, for the witches. And it sounded like said watchers at first, but they said for the witches. But they threw this bread down and they said for the witches, but it sounded like for the watchers. And I was like, the watchers? There's watchers down there? And then I said, no, they're Scottish, and they said witches. And then I let it go. And then Galus was trying to, like, connect with Claire. Like, hey, we're in this together. And Claire's still, like, super pissed off. Mm-hmm. Galus is like, the baby's kicking. It's a boy. And she, like, tries, do you want to feel it? And Claire's like, F you. I don't want to touch your belly. I'm mad at you. You got me in this position. And then... I wrote this down in regards to the food. Here's food, and they threw it in a half a loaf of bread. I was like, I clearly would have died in the thieves' hole between the drop and the lack of protein. Galus' tactics change when she hears of Dougal's banishment. And I said, that is an elaborate thieves' hole. I'm like, all these notes I didn't talk about before. I said, more of a thieves' cavern. But yeah, no, she was like, sleep closer to me, we'll share warmth. And Claire's like, I'm good, thanks.
So in the morning, they ascend the ladder and they're taken to the courtroom. They're tied up and, you know, kind of walk through the town to the courtroom.
I was like, I saw that and I was like, oh, look, I have a pet Sassenach.
Summer.
The only thing I was going to say, because before they get to the thing, it was the next morning when they were like, everyone get up, and you could hear the chanting of the children. I was like, that was the most, like, unenthusiastic chant ever. They were all saying, burn the witch, but they couldn't even be bothered to care about it. It was like, burn the witch. I was like, come on, children's chorus. Care about it, at least.
So they're taken to the courtroom, and they actually stand together in the, not sure what the proper term is, but in that box, and it's announced that they are standing for the crime of witchcraft. And they are accused of, I quote, "They did inflict pain, suffering, and death upon the citizens of Kreinsmere by their practice of the unholy arts." And shortly thereafter, Ned arrives.
Even before that,
apparently I leave out a lot of my favorite episode.
You did. I thought that everyone in the quote-unquote courtroom was incredibly bored. They all looked bored. I was like,
because they wanted to see a fire.
I guess they were bored. They were purely bored. And I personally, as a book reader, preferred the open air proceedings. I thought them being in a planned internal environment almost gave it too much forethought, and it almost belied the hysteria of that incident, because mm-hmm. in the books they're like, oh, we don't even, it's Kreinsmere, such a small little village mm-hmm. that they don't even have that. So where do they do this? Oh, we'll just go down by the river. We're going to mm-hmm. take everyone down by the river, and everyone's going to gather. We don't have a place to do it. Doesn't matter if it's going to rain. Doesn't matter if it's windy. Doesn't matter the weather. Everyone's going to show up at this predetermined spot down by the river, because that's where we're going to try these riches. And I was kind of disappointed.
Whenever I hear down by the river, I think of Chris Farley.
In a van down by the river. Yeah, that was not in this episode. And I also, what else wasn't in this episode?
He's passed, unfortunately.
Was a witch pricker.
Yeah, I know.
I missed the witch pricker.
Well, no, there was no witch picker in the other one, remember?
He was supposed to come. Him.
In this episode?
No.
In the book.
In the book.
In the book they were going to, and then he couldn't come or something. Remember that?
I remember there was a witch picker mentioned. There was no witch picker. I promise you, I would have remembered if there's a witch picker.
Mentioned, because, and I'm kind of glad, almost like Elena, I don't know who Elena is. I'm kind of glad Diana left the witch picker out. I mean, she mentions him, but he never shows up.
Well, but in the
because if he was there, there would have been some pricking and torture going on.
I know, but what happened in the book, if I'm not mistaken, was they made a big mention about how the proceedings they were going to do and what was going to be expected of them to prove they were not witches, and that's what made Claire's outburst happen. Where she was like, that's stupid, I'm not going to do that. And they were like, oh, you're in contempt of the court. And that's when they started whipping her. That's what I remember from the book. Is that not true?
Well, they were outside. They had taken them down by the river. And the test was going to be, will they float?
Right.
Stop it.
Sorry. I'm Chris Farling in my head. Thank you.
They were going to, like, tie her up or something, right? And, like, throw her in the river. This is one of the tests for purity, or tests if you're a witch. If you
drowned, you were not a witch.
And therefore, but you survived, probably maybe go to heaven, but you were dead. Well, obviously that. But if you didn't sink, then you were a witch.
Right, which makes me
think
of...
And women have more body fat. I mean, in those times, they may have been bony. But women, comparatively, have more body fat, and they have the boobs. So, if anyone's going to float, it's going to be the women. However, the dresses are going to make them sink.
Generally, your lungs are full of air, which helps you float, generally.
Yeah, but
until you start drowning, and then it's done.
Those dresses would have taken them down.
But past that, this whole thing that... The witch trials and stuff makes me think of Monty Python's Holy Grail, where they talk about how can we tell if she's a witch? And they were like, well, it has to float. So they're like, well, wood floats. Yeah, but and then they said something else about wood. So they finally were like, well, let's get a duck. And if the duck floats and she floats like a duck, then if it's a duck, then it's the witch. There's this whole thing about the witch trials and the Monty Python, which makes me laugh. But yeah, I remember that from the book that they had I thought they brought in a witch pricker. Oh, they were calling for one, and that there was a whole sequence by the river, and the thing that made her outburst that turned into the flogging for her was her refusing to undertake the test they were wanting her to do.
The test, yes, but that was not done by the witch pricker. The witch pricker, traditionally, if I'm not mistaken, I've had a little bit too much reading on this. The witch pricker was someone...
Too much reading? Never.
On this topic, never. So a witch pricker is someone who would travel around, and they may or may not have had another job, but something that one of their jobs was they would travel around and do the testing, I guess you would say, outside of it. I don't mean tests like the whole water test and other tests like that, but they would prick them literally, they had, you know, needles and pokers or whatever. They would do different tests, and there may be a better term for that. But they would do certain things, and, for example, if they poked a certain thing or found a certain thing, then that they would claim that they would, like, they would find that's part of the body that, say, wouldn't bleed or didn't have a lot of blood flow. I don't know. They would do something.
They had collapsible needles. I remember. They had, like...
They had
a bunch of, like, fake dummy tests that pretty much no one could pass, which is something that Claire had mentioned in the beginning of this episode, that almost no one survived
that
a witch
accusation.
Trial.
Absolutely. And one of the things that they used, and I can't think of the name, although I used to know the name. I think there were actually two men who wrote it, or two men who collaborated on it. One of the things that was used in the early modern times, so during the witch craze, if you will, the modern early modern witch hunts, was a Latin document, which, okay, a lot of things were obviously written in Latin back then, and that were circulated, was the Malleus Maleficarum, the witch's hammer. And that gave, like, basically the order of how things were going to... I wouldn't say how a witch trial was supposed to take place, but how to test witches, how to punish them, what to do with them, etc. So, and you can get that on, like, the English translation, or the Latin if you want, from, like, you know, Project Gutenberg, all kinds of, it's totally public domain, it's free to find. It's very interesting. It's a little freaky, but it's very interesting. So, we're back in the courtroom, and Ned arrives. He pulls out the first thing, like the first and easiest.
I'm sure you can read it from there.
Ned
Gowan!
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to feverishly take notes last night. While watching, and, like, they get more and more difficult to read because I didn't want to keep pausing it, so I was trying to write as fast as I could, and I'm having a hard time rereading them. So there's going to be some deciphering as I try to join you.
So... the first thing Ned tries is to get it, literally to get it canceled. He brings up some, it was a pretty smart move. I don't know if that law actually exists or existed.
It had to have.
Who knows?
He is clearly a brilliant trial lawyer.
Of course, but I'm saying, like, it's for the story. It could be fake.
I agree. I'm just saying that the way they've written Ned in this episode,
he is
brilliant. Like, he diffused
most so
much of the arguments that he came up against.
Oh my gosh, there's one thing he did, which is obviously, it's not from the book, which, totally fine, not a problem, but something he did, which I thought, holy crap, again, just another thing that Tony Graffia, and I'm not sure how much influence he had, you know, when they break the story down and talk about elements, I don't know if it was completely her idea to add this, or what, but, oh my gosh, that scene, and we'll get to it. He not only diffused arguments, he diffused a lot of things. We'll get to that. So the Scottish law, he says, people have a right to accuse of witchcraft. People have a right to a defense lawyer.
No, and not only
after he couldn't get it canceled,
but he pits English law against Scottish law.
Yep,
knowing that the Scottish people present don't care for the English.
Yeah,
therefore they'd be like, well, so you're saying by Scottish law they're entitled to a lawyer, but the English say they won't. Well, I guess we don't want to be like the English, so of course we're going to let them have a trial lawyer. So
forget that she's a Sassenach,
right?
Although technically, I mean, she is by birth, but technically she's a Scots woman now that she's married to a Scot. That's what they said. That's the whole thing that got her off from having to go meet with BJR. She's technically a Scot.
Well,
now.
That didn't even come up, really.
Well, I know, but she's still a Sassenach.
That was more of a book thing.
No, that was an episode before they were married.
Okay.
That was the whole reason. He had no domain, if you will. Dominion, whatever. He had no say. He couldn't force a Scots woman to come see him. But if she were still English... then he could. So the first witness called up is Jeannie. And I'm like, I'm not going to lie, I was a little surprised.
But I want you to know that as I'm looking at my notes, like I said last night, I was feverishly trying to write them while I watched at the same time. The only thing I can read right now is effing Jeannie. That's literally it.
Oh, yeah. So she's Gillis's housekeeper.
Effing Jeannie.
And I think it was Claire's, it must have been Claire's voiceover. Basically, she starts off and she starts talking, and then it goes to, like, some, like, a montage, not montage, but, like, you know, like, a voiceover while she's still mimicking talking. And the voiceover said, she went on for the better part of an hour. I'm like, are you kidding me? I wrote, wow, she was determined. And she mentioned amulets, potions, singing, incantations. Gaelis laughs. I mean, Gaelis, you're not helping yourself.
I've deciphered another sentence here, which states, she's an effing liar. Because she is.
Someone else mentions the testimony of a cat. I'm like, this is like, yeah, okay, this is going on. So and Ned...
Then, yeah, that was funny when he was like, oh, she scared the cats away with her singing. I'm like, I know a lot of people who are tone deaf that scare animals.
So Ned says she tried to get a position, the housekeeper, Jeannie. Didn't you try to get a position at Leah? And he says, because you're underpaid and under-admired. And he says that you called Galus a flibbertigibbet. And I wrote...
Wait, what did you... you didn't write down what she said about Arthur? And I'm only asking that because I can't read the last word.
No.
That just, I wrote. Flatulent, old, and then skumph. There's
I didn't write that
something
down.
With a sk at the beginning.
No.
And a P.
Forever. From this point and on ever. And that didn't make sense.
Are you thinking about Sound of Music?
Yes!
He's a problem like Maria? She's a problem like Maria.
I don't
Maria.
Know. Wait, Galus? No.
Yeah. He's a flibbertigibbet.
A will-o'-the-wisp. A clown.
A clown.
So, the second witness is... Okay, I am going to butcher his name because...
Wasn't it Rubina?
I wrote Rubita.
I heard Rubina.
It could have been that. It could have been either. But it was something Donaldson.
Rubina.
And this... As soon as you saw... Well, when she first got up, you're like, oh, who's this? And then the second she, like, opened her mouth and started talking about, you're like, oh, to the no. This could be...
This is the serious one. This is the first thing that Claire couldn't physically lie about.
Exactly. Well, she couldn't deny that she was there. We find out that she is the changeling's mom. She described Claire taking the child and, quote, speaking spells over it. The crowd then calls Claire a witch, and she protests, saying, I'm a healer. I was trying to save it. Ned tries to get her to Simadana. She's like, you're not helping yourself. You need to be quiet. And then Ned does something, one of the many things, but probably the most ingenious thing he does.
Before that, let's stop for a second. I wrote, Claire, shut up. You aren't helping yourself. Like, I mean, if the subtitle for this entire episode could be Claire, shut up. Because every
That's
time
the
she...
subtitle for almost every other
I know,
episode.
But especially this one because literally her life was on the line.
Yeah.
Claire, literally. Shut up.
Well, her life is always on the line.
I know. But especially here.
Poor Claire, not the nuns.
Because
poor Claire.
Claire one-on-one with her life on the line, that sucks. But, you know, it's one-on-one, which means she could get away or somebody could show up and help. Claire...
One on 100
and whatever, however many people there are in Cranesmuir, is a little bit more difficult to diffuse. That's all I'm saying.
So Ned, as I was saying, does something quite ingenious here. Probably my favorite thing that he does over... The most touching thing that he does. There was likely no way to get her off completely, and he realizes this, to get her out of this accusation, since she did mess with the child. But he took as much blame off of her as he could by getting the mother to admit that by not confronting Claire and allowing her to, quote, contaminate the child, the fairies weren't able to complete the exchange. The young mother nods. I'm not bawling, but I am tearing up here, too, because this young mother, yes, she's, like, accusing her of witchcraft, but she is just gone through the worst thing imaginable.
She has, and she is clearly trying to find someone to blame.
Yeah.
And I think when Ned came up and dealt with her so delicately.
Gently, yes.
And gently and told her.
And kindly.
You know, and the first thing he said was, you know, I want to basically offer you condolences on the loss of your child. But when you think about it, why didn't you say anything?
Exactly.
You saw her come into it and you knew that the fairies were coming.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you allow her to contaminate the scene so that they couldn't finish what they were going to start?
And then
you see her just going like, I was too scared.
Yes. And then he says, and this is one... I mean, goodness, I don't know how many times... Seriously, Tony's becoming one of my favorites. I don't know how many times I'm going to say. I think I've already done it like 3 times now. And we'll see. The favorite line's coming up. This is one of... And I wrote it down, again, verbatim. Ned tells the young mother, take comfort in knowing it was the changeling child that died. and that your own child is healthy, living forever with the fairies. I mean, I know he was trying to, like, help the mom, console her, give her something to hope for, right? Her baby's still alive somewhere, if this is truly her belief. And he can't get Claire out of that box. But he can maybe diffuse this little bit of this one.
Well, and that's what he did, though. And up until effing Leary.
Oh, my gosh.
He literally, it's like, set him up, knock him down. Set him up, knock him down. And that's what happened. Like, somebody would show up, and they'd be like, blah, 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 they're witches. And then he'd be like, but really? And then they'd be like, okay, you're right. You're excused. And, like, what I wrote about the changeling mother is that I was like, dude, uneducated people are annoying. They're annoying. And I know that that's a lot of it is just the time period and the beliefs of that time period. But I was just like, seriously, you thought a fairy person literally took your child. And if you left your dying baby out in the wild in the cold and uncared for, that somebody would come and magically deliver your healthy child back to you in exchange for the sickly child. And you would get your healthy child back. I'm like, I can't rationalize that in my brain.
Because usually there's some, truth. There's usually something to legends and stories, right? Where some kernel of truth of some kind, maybe not the main part of it, that at least stories can grow on. I can't think of any time where someone would have left a baby or I mean, I get the hope of it. I get the hope and trying to have that hope when your child is ill or dying. I understand the belief for the hope, but the actual practice of leaving a sick child and they come back, what? Is it usually gone? Because I understand putting it out there to send to the fairy if they think it's a changeling, but to expect your own baby to come back, did they have proof? There's no proof. Did they have, like, hearsay or something that it actually ever worked? That's my point. Did anyone ever report getting a healthy baby back?
I'm sure it was clearly all old wives' tales. That's all they could have at that point. And it makes me think of, like, the people who...
And if all you have is hope, you're going to do it. You're going to do
it. But it's the people who refuse modern medical help because of quote-unquote religious reasons.
They may not be quote-unquote, but they may be religious for them, but yeah.
But they're just like, oh, I don't believe in modern medicine. Now, granted, this was a different time period. It was the 1700s. They do not have those things. But it's frustrating to me to watch that go down. And I'm like, oh, my God. The last thing I would do if my child was sick was to put it out in the freaking wilderness and hide, like, 100 feet away. And you're also hopefully wait.
Not an 18th century
uneducated woman. I know I'm not. But also, can we talk about the fact that the baby was dead before Claire ever got to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this woman had no idea. I mean, she knew who was ill, but this woman...
Dude, of course she had no idea. She thought the fairies were coming to replace it.
Claire says, quote, "As I looked around the room at these good people, I wondered what made them so ready to watch us burn regardless of the evidence."
Do you want to know what I thought about that?
They only wanted one outcome.
Do you know what I thought about that? Hmm. Why they wanted them to burn for no other reason?
Because they had no TV.
Because they were cold. Summer. They looked cold. Every last one of them looked cold. And I literally wrote that. I said, what made them so ready to want to watch us burn? And I said, clearly they were cold.
So then the third witness comes forward, Alistair Duffy.
He was dumb. Like, he just... What made me so angry about him is what came out of his mouth was the most ridiculous of anything that anyone said, and everyone glommed onto it like it was the most righteous moment of truth they had ever experienced.
He charges Galus, and he says he saw her call down a storm, and then I wrote, here's a shout out to Deborah Harkness's All Souls trilogy, would that be which wind or which water?
You're a nerd.
Just a bit. And then she leapt into the sky and flew like a... Was it a bat?
She, like,
flew like a bat.
Flung off her cloak and flew into the sky. And I was like, okay, legit, you are literally the worst witness so far, and everyone is eating it up. Like
they love it.
I was just like, this is dumb.
Okay. Then there's a break in the trial. Claire asks if Colum sent Ned to help her. No. In fact, Ned says he would not look favorably upon his being there. That's a little heartbreaking. When Claire asks, If Colm had something to do with her arrest, Ned doesn't answer.
You know what my response would have been to that?
And then he sends her off with some whiskey.
He does. But my response to that would have been like, dude, I massaged his butt and made him more comfortable.
I was like, you did
walk.
What?
Got it. She did. Colm. She was like, I'm going to massage things that no one massages.
You to make you feel better. You don't know what Letitia does.
You already don't, but I'm pretty sure she looks kind of frigid.
You mean you think she is?
I think she looks kind of frigid.
Okay. So then after that break in the court for that day, they take a, I guess you'd call it a recess, and they go back to the thieves' hole. Second night there. The ladies are drinking. I mean, what else is there to do?
I know, and this is something that's going to come up. It's going to come up repeatedly.
What, drinking?
Yes, drinking. Pregnant people drinking.
Oh, that. Sorry.
And I don't, when did that become a big thing where we knew that it was a problem?
When they, I mean, my guess, and I'm not a post-human medically trained person in human anatomy and all that.
So
they,
like the 80s or 70s or
80s? No. I'm thinking between the 60s, or between the 70s and 80s. 70s and early 80s. I could be wrong, but I think it was specifically connected with fetal alcohol syndrome.
Correct. Clearly this is not that time period.
Well, Summer, have you been watching the show? Have
I
you
know,
read the books?
I know. I have read the books. My only thought is that Galus was from 1968. So technically, in that period of time, she would have been aware of fetal alcohol syndrome. Though, she also thought
but
she was going
not
to
have
burn.
Been, it may not have been in the late 60s. It could have been in the late 70s. I don't know.
Okay, my point
she
being,
obviously didn't know.
Yes.
Or didn't care.
Or she thought she was dying, so it didn't matter.
That's true. So they're down there, and Galus says, they mean to kill us. Claire says, was it Dougal or position and money you were after? And thus, the story unfolds. We find out so much from Galus, and her backstory is finally begun. So Galus, since she's been married to Arthur, had been diverting his money. And she says it's for Scotland. She's a Jacobite. And then I wrote, this Jacobite thing comes up again. Politics brought the two of them together. Galus says that he was the only man she could see who could be her proper match. In the show, on the...
Which is funny because later she says, when Claire says, you really do love him, and she's like, you said that, not me. Mm-hmm. Which is funny because she's like, he's the only man who could be my proper match, but she wouldn't admit... To loving him.
In the show, or I should say here in this episode, on the eve of the Battle of Culloden, obviously this is not literally the eve, but the metaphoric eve, the figurative eve, here she, Galus, says something so touching. Colm fights for the Mackenzies. Dougal fights for the McKennons, the McPhersons, the Chisholms, the Camerons, and all of the clans, and all of Scotland. Again, I'm going to get a little tear prick here. Another, whatever you think about Galus, imagine if you read the books, you have an opinion of her, I get it. Whatever you think about Galus, at least the way Lotta is playing her, she may not say, and she didn't say the words either, about Scotland either, but she may not say that she loves Dougal, or not. She had she had strong faith that he would come rescue her, but then was, you know, shocked and kind of broken down when she realized that he had gone and didn't, you know, wasn't around. But Scotland is her true love. Galus has a moment, another one, of facing facts. Colm orders him to go, and off he went, meaning Dougal. There's a slight catch in her breath that belies her feelings. Claire says, I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country. And this line, I looked it
Nathan
up.
Nathan Hale.
Is attributed to Nathan Hale, a soldier for the Continental Army during the American Revolution. He volunteered for an intelligence gathering mission in New York City, but was captured by the British and executed. And also, just by the by, some historians have questioned the reliability of the account that reported this line or paraphrased speech that he gave before his hanging. So it's still attributed to him, but it's not 100% certain.
The only thing I was able to find was it was the 1700s, which would have been appropriate to this time period, but it still should have totally,
but
like...
But the Revolutionary would have been in the 1770s.
I know, but what I'm saying is that it still should have been like, boop, hey, Galus, this woman is Hopefully. Clearly not of this time period. Also, Thieves' Hole, 2 days.
in the series. In the book, it was like weeks.
It felt like weeks. Longer.
They made it sound like they were in the dark, alone, for an extended period of time.
In the thieves' hole, the camera is on Galus so much. As Summer already said, this is truly her episode. In the mostly dark hole, she looks like a painting. Her dress askew, her hair over one shoulder, the light bouncing off of her face and décolletage. She asks Claire if she loves Jamie, and that she says that she calls out his name in her sleep. And then I wrote in caps, cue the Jamie and Claire theme. And then Claire looks up and sees the bird, a bird, is only one at this point, and when she sees the starling through the gate, she mentions a few facts about them. As Summer, that they're called a memoration. She talked about how they stay together for protection. And I wrote a little, I didn't look this up because I knew a little bit. I volunteered with wildlife quite a bit. And we had a lot of...
Of course you did.
You know this. We had a lot of starlings, baby starlings. Although not native to the U.S., they are very interesting birds. I've worked with them in wildlife rehabilitation and as nestlings and juveniles. They are dirty and noisy. I mean, you want to clasp your hands over your ears when you're feeding about 20 of them. It's just a lot. But they are very, very smart. Not quite as smart as corvids, but smart.
What's a corvid?
A corvid is like the scrub jays.
Crows. She compared starlings to crows.
I'm saying they're not as smart as corvids.
I know. I'm just saying in the episode, they compare starlings to crows.
Well, then a crow's a corvid. There was a bird that was adopted. And this is a starling. There was a bird that was adopted because he'd become habituated and he couldn't be released. And his name was Chaos. And the reason we know his name was Chaos is because he said his name.
Shut up.
I'm not lying.
You're... No, you are
lying. I am not lying. No. I can connect you with people in my life who can vouch for this. I was there. I heard it.
Literally go back and videotape that.
He's gone. He found a new home. So his owner...
Where?
He was adopted. Somewhere he's habituated. He can't be released.
Really? Adopted where? Like in a home?
In a cage.
Can you not find them?
Summer, I don't...
I legit want you to have I want an audio clip of him saying,
"The bird...
My name is Chaos."
No, he doesn't say that. He just said... Chaos, but not in that voice, in his own voice. That
sounds much fun. I want him to say, "My name is Chaos."
So the bird said his name. Yes, a starling said his own name, and he said Chaos. He had a few other words too, I think, but it was so amazing. This starling would mimic different things, obviously. So while they are prolific poopers and just...
What?
They are. Is that a thing? The baby birds. The summer, all baby
birds. Prolific poopers?
When you're rehabbing birds and you're feeding them every 15
minutes. Okay,
I'm
not rehabbing birds, and I want you to know that came as a bit of a shock.
So while they are prolific poopers and just messy birds, again, in a basket in a rehab facility where you are trying to raise basically 50 to 80 at a time and feeding every 15 minutes, it's overwhelming, but they are a joy.
I want you to know that on your tombstone, I'm going to write, "You were a prolific pooper."
You better not. And then
she was a prolific pooper.
And this is when Claire mentions the murmuration. They fly in patterns, and it's to protect each other.
It's also to creep the shit out of me.
Yes, that is true. That's the secondary reason. And again, what beautiful writing. Love this metaphor. Anything else to say before we leave the thieves' hole?
The only thing that I wrote is that before they left the thieves' hole for the last time, is that it seemed like Galus finally acknowledged the fact that no one was coming. And then right before the last time they lowered that ladder in, which, for the record, that was awesome. They lowered the ladder because I was like, how else are they going to be helping them out of there? Even though they threw them in, they needed to come out a little more easily.
Mm-hmm.
That she reached out and literally touched her baby bump before they went out for the last time. Like, she refused to touch her for the however many days were before then, like...
Like the one day.
Oh, the baby's kicking. Touch it. And she's like, no. Not interested. I'm cold. Hold me. Nope. Not going to go there. And then the last day, she's like,
Let
me touch your baby bump.
Yes. And maybe we saw things differently. I agree. She did go to her very willingly. But as they're leaving the thieves' hole for the last time, Claire puts her hand on Galus's stomach. Galus stops her. And then brings her hand to her lips and kissed it. So Galus didn't shove her away, but I think Claire wanted to make more of a thing about it. And what I took from it is that Galus basically stopped her. Didn't push her away. The reason I think that is because, first of all, it looked like that. And also, people were there to help them get out. So they had observers. She did not want her secret to be gone. And as she's sitting there letting Claire massage her stomach going, oh, you know, even if she doesn't say the words, she doesn't want her secret out yet. She wants to be able to let it go when it's time and don't sing.
No, I see that. I see exactly what you're saying. Because there were people watching. And when there weren't people watching, she was like, touch it, the baby's kicking. Yeah. And then there's people there. She's like, shh. I can see that. I do think it was kind that they had a ladder to pull them back out.
Yes, of course. And then also something about that ladder. I wonder if there's any significance to this. As they were leaving, Galus goes first, and she takes the hand offered her, and they help her out. The hand is also there for Claire. Claire does not take that hand.
Of course
she doesn't. She walks up. Climbs up.
Of course she doesn't. Claire's a little bit of a B.A.
A B.A.
By B.A., I mean badass.
Yeah, I got it. So, courtroom day two. And literally, I swear she sashayed down that aisle. Leary, I wrote in caps, in comes Leary. And as soon as I saw Leary, I wrote, uh-oh, it's over with.
I literally wrote, Q effing Leary.
Whereas before I did, even with the slap, even with the ill wish, I still had pity for Leary. I'm not thinking the future. I'm just thinking about the show.
I feel no pity for her. And
not
I have
feel,
a
felt.
Okay. Well, I don't write in the past tense. I write in the present tense. And I felt nothing but, like, anger and a little bit of, like, disdain at her. And yeah. I have lots of
bad language.
Inappropriate bad language
exactly.
that I wrote about
so
her.
So what I was trying to say was, whereas before I had pity for her, even with the slap, I wrote, now, no way.
Nope. She earned that slap. She was a B-I-T-C-H.
Of course so. Dang. Nell certainly does bring it. She did a great job. She did a great job making us hate her.
If by it you mean infantile 16-year-old, I care nothing about anything but my own existence, then you're absolutely right. She brought it.
And this was also interesting. Did you catch it?
I caught a lot of stuff.
I don't know.
I may need the vaccination.
I was about to say, that's between you and your doctor. But I don't know. I didn't write it down. I don't know if it was Galus or Claire. I think it was Galus because, I don't know who it was. Crocodile tears.
That was totally Claire.
Okay. So
Larry
no one.
Have said that.
No one. Okay. Number one, I don't know how old that term is.
I'll Google it.
I know they can let Claire say things, but they have to be careful in what context because then if it's truly anachronistic, people have to react. And no one reacted to that. Unless, I mean, she is on trial for witchcraft, so who cares what she says, but...
I mean, it was used by Shakespeare and Henry the...
Oh, well, then we're fine.
Yeah.
Never mind. It's all good.
And also in Henry Purcell's 1688 opera, Dido and Aeneas.
What did you just say?
Dido and Aeneas?
Dido and Aeneas. Aeneas, I know it. It was an opera. I studied
Aeneas.
Classical music. Not that
Dido
opera.
And Aeneas.
That's almost what you said. After the crocodile tears lady walks away, in comes Father Bane.
No, but can I say this is like the most badass entrance ever?
Like,
it was
he's
like
total
backlit and like rock star.
It was.
Like,
exactly.
For
I wrote,
sure.
Uh-oh. I wrote, his entry is so commanding, really effective, very effective, excellent actor. Tim McInerney, crazy, crazy good. Another one. I wrote, this is another twist. In the book, he confronts her about a wound that is infected and festering.
I thought they were going to show this. Like, I remember them posting about dogs.
The dog. Yeah,
and
I thought so too,
him?
But apparently
I thought for
not.
Sure they would have shown this. They didn't. And
it's not about not showing it. It's about including it.
No, but before we go to that, can we talk about the fact that she's effing 16 and she's blathering on about the love of her life? I'm like, you're 16.
But that's what 16-year-olds do.
They do.
Exactly.
That being said, though, the congregation of
believing her.
Hopefully rational human beings.
Okay,
they're
yelling, burn the witch.
Okay.
Burn the witch!
But
we love Wicked, too.
But that being said,
Idina, you're...
Stop it.
Invited anytime.
Stop it. That being said, I feel like rational human beings should have been like, you're 16.
Wait, it wasn't
your heart
Idina.
What broken.
What was she called?
Adela Dazeem.
Adela Dazeem. You're invited anytime.
Yes. Not Idina. Idina, you don't have time for us, but
Adela
Dazeem.
We would love her.
Okay, that being said,
I feel like
that was the best
rational
thing ever.
Humans should have been like, this is not a rational response to what's going on. You're 16. Your feelings
but
are
again,
hurt.
But again, they're cold and they have no TV.
Yeah, but your feelings are hurt. We should recognize the fact that somebody spurned you. You didn't
and
like
you're upset.
That. And now you're upset about it.
So back to Father Bane. He
best entrance.
Oh my!
He
best
was backlit and everything.
Yeah, you already said that.
I'm gonna say it again because it was awesome.
So he used her speech to condemn her in the book. Her speech to him, meaning
no,
take care of that wound no. or it's gonna fester
take
and it'll
a
become
moment.
Infected.
The way that they did this, I literally wrote, "Wait, did he just speak on her behalf?" And then
almost.
I said, "Dot dot dot." Nope.
Exactly. Nope. So in the book, he uses her own speech against her to condemn her. Here, he masterfully humbles himself before his congregation and uses that as a weapon
to condemn
her.
Can we just all caps put that? Masterfully? All caps.
I use it a few times, yeah.
All caps, because I literally went... I got confused when
Me
he
too.
Started speaking on
Me
her
too.
Behalf, and I was
he
like,
started,
wait.
He started like, oh my gosh, they changed
Hold
the character.
On. And then all of a sudden, and then when the judge was like, you are not allowed to leave this district.
Yep.
You are condemned to stay here.
You're like,
go back to your seat. And he literally looks at Claire and he smirks. And I was like, nope.
There you go.
Nope.
This is what I wrote as well. He had me for a second. I was thinking, where is this going? And then... yes. And then she is... Claire screams at one point, I have done nothing.
I mean... Though, in her defense... No, not in her defense. Against her defense. She hasn't done nothing. She's been actively trying to heal people the entire time she's
Except
there.
When she
you
offered,
can't say she's
well,
done nothing. She has been doing her best to stay true to herself as a healer. And not... All the time is that in the best interest of her
well, let's
own
just,
self.
Let's just say this, and I know we're not in other books, and we're not going to talk about any kind of storylines or details. Well, okay, I guess I can't say anything. Never mind. Ned requests a recess again.
Before that, Claire needs to shut up. She's not helping herself. Like, she's the
whole time.
Worst witness in her own defense.
Absolutely. So Ned requests a recess, and the women then go into an antechamber. And I think this is probably my favorite scene. Outside of, okay, the end with Jamie, of course, that's awesome. But this, I think, is my favorite scene between the two women. They go into some sort of antechamber, and they lay it down.
No, and
Ned
no,
says,
before that,
we
before
can
the
save
two of them are
one
alone,
of you.
Before they're alone, Ned is in there with them, and he's like, we can save one of you. Clearly, Galus, it's not you. That
Pretty
being,
much.
That being said... The only way that one of you can survive is by Claire stating that Galus turned her into a witch or made her do all of the witchy things that were inopportune.
She's being accused of.
You're right.
Yeah.
She was accused of. So, and Galus is like, are you effing kidding me? What? I had nothing to do with that. And Claire's like, no, I don't want to do that. So, it was an awkward scene because basically Ned's saying the only way I can get one of you off
is if you throw under the bus.
Is if you throw the other one under the bus.
And that's what I wrote. Ned bus. Totally tries to throw Galus under the bus.
No,
and
Galus
get
is like, what?
Claire to throw her under the bus. So the bottom of my stomach fell out at this suggestion. Galus's face just like, she's like, are you, what'd you say? Are you my lawyer or my something? I mean, it was like, are you kidding me?
No, but legit though. Galus should have known that Ned was not there for her.
I don't disagree, but I was still kind of shocked too. That it was surprising, but he was truly, truly trying to help. So he then leaves to give them a little bit of time. Galus turns, is like, look, we got minutes. And she says, and I wrote in caps, why are you here? And Claire's like, because I have. And she's like, you're so lying. No more lies, Claire.
You've
if
been
I'm,
lying.
If I'm,
I met you.
If I'm going to die, if I'm going to burn as a witch, I need to know I'm dying for something. And this is when, and I'm going to get it again, this is when she starts to have a little breakdown again as well. And I'm like, girl, you're tear-pricking me. Stop it. She kills it in this scene. Claire comes clean
finally, she's like, okay, I know. We're about to die here. I have nothing to lose. I got to tell her.
She came clean, but she almost gave nothing away.
Well, that's true. She never said stoned.
I'm not here on purpose.
She says it was an accident.
It was an accident. And then Galus is like, I'm going to die for an accident.
Galus, to me, looks heartbroken. She's dumbfounded about the reason why Claire is there. She says, so you don't want to change things or do anything at all, do you?
Well, that whole statement solidified the fact that she herself
is there for a reason.
Was there for a reason. And then the moment that she realized that she wasn't getting off no matter what, the only thing that she could do was to help get Claire off. And she was like, I'm going to get you off, and but it's not going to mean anything. I'm going to give everything up that I've been here trying to do for nothing.
Yes. Gayla says nothing. It's really all for nothing. And then about this point, Ned comes back in and says he can't delay the court any longer. What are you going to do? The best. And then there is one point where he actually comes in and Claire's like, a few moments. No, and he goes away.
A moment.
And then he goes away. But now he's like, I cannot hold it up any longer. What are you going to do? And this is the best line of the night. There's a tiny bit of a beat.
Are you talking about Galus's line? Yes! Okay, before you say it, I want to say that this is a line that if it is not featured in Entertainment Weekly as a soundbite of the week, that somebody is not doing their job.
Okay, so there's that beat after Ned says, what are you guys going to do? She looks at Ned, and I think she looks at Claire, and she's like, okay, let's get the show on the road. Let's get down to business. And she says, looks like I'm going to an effing barbecue.
Exactly.
And it's going to be
an **ing barbecue. BBQ.
LOL is what I wrote. If Claire didn't get a hint right there, Claire has said, well, okay, the whole Jacobite thing doesn't necessarily...
No, but I didn't look it up, but I wrote a note saying, when did barbecue become a thing?
Oh,
the word... 1756, Samuel Johnson gave the following definitions to barbecue, a term for dressing a whole hog. So 1700s, 1756 is about when it started. But still, I thought that was definitely more of a modern phrase.
Yes.
Than I expected from Galus. That should have been
used sarcastically in this.
Been your first indication that this was not someone of the time period.
So Claire, when they get back out to the courtroom, into the box, Claire refuses to speak against Galus.
Into the box. Okay.
They are both condemned to death for witchcraft.
That happened really quickly, by the way.
Very quickly. Galus, I wrote, Galus, as they have a few moments left out there in the box before things, you know, go to town, Galus now, I wrote, gives away her goodies. She says, the question you had before I think it's
that,
possible.
Can we talk about the fact that all of a sudden Ned shows up with guns?
Yeah, that was awkward.
They're like, you're all condemned to death. And he's like, I forbid it. And he pulls out, like, guns. I was like, what?
And then one goes off as they're... But I couldn't tell. I don't think he's shot. But one goes off and he like falls back because they're on him.
They definitely like restrained him.
Yes.
Are you okay over there?
I thought there was a cat behind me.
Okay. They definitely restrained him. But at the time I was like, dude, calm down.
So what Galus says to Claire, the question you had before, I think it's possible. And then she says, 1968.
Okay.
Difference. And I wrote, so there may not be a cave scene.
They
Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, but they have to have the cave scene. It makes Dougal extra creepy.
It does. You're right. Well, this information is given early then, which is okay.
And that's what I wrote.
But she still needs to hear about other stuff with Galus, so yeah.
No, and I thought, and I wrote this... This comes in differently, but still moving. I thought I still had chill bumps when she said it.
Oh, totally.
I enjoyed the fact that Galus told her and the fact she didn't get it right away. Stop it. She's tear breaking right now. I can see it in her face.
Stop my tear breaking.
Okay. It was moving to see her give that information directly to Claire.
Yes.
Knowing that later on
it would hit her.
Right. But in the book, it didn't come until much later. And then when Dougal said it to her, he said 4 digits, 1968.
Which took Claire a time.
It took her more time to put together because when you don't say 1968, 1968 is indicative of a year. When you say
unless you're going to the store.
Right. But when you say 1968, it doesn't have nearly as much meaning as 1968.
So as I wrote, Ned had been trying to shoot a gun and he was wrestled and it went off and he was carried away. So hopefully Ned is safe. Claire again gets quite passionate, yelling at the court, and she's ordered.
She needs to stop, dude.
Yeah, well, it's over with. She's ordered to be lashed. And then I wrote, what mercurial balance. Jamie and his wife have now both been lashed. Different degrees, definitely. Clearly. But still.
Clearly.
So then as she hasn't been whipped yet, but as she's being taken over to be whipped, Leary says to her, I shall dance on your ashes. I'm like, oh, man, give me a whip.
Dude, I wanted to punch her directly in her face. And I'm sorry, Nell Hudson. My saying that implies that you're doing your job.
Exactly. That's a very good way to put it.
That being said, though, I still want to punch you in your face. Because telling a woman who's about to be lashed because of lies that you have told in front of her to a bunch of people makes me literally think that karma isn't working fast enough.
Claire is lashed in a different way than in the book, but still very effective. And
the only way it was different was the fact that she wasn't... It was indoors. Other than that, she was lashed.
It was the same. But watching Claire get whipped was difficult. It wasn't just the look on her face and the sounds. It was Galus's reaction. Lotta, dude, she teared up in there. I'm just like, so Claire is sitting there like screaming in pain. Lotta's watching her like, oh my God, Claire.
It's true, but you have to know that this follows the fact that Ned said, you need to denounce Galus. The only way we can make this work is for one of you to survive. And then when they get back into the court and he goes to Claire and he says, she has something to say. And Claire says, I have nothing to say. You were wrong, because Claire will not sell her only friend out. Mm-hmm. And then to then go from, I'm not selling you out. And Galus is like, what the hell? I totally just told you to do it. And then she's being flogged. And Galus is like, I can't stand here and do nothing.
Oh, gosh. Exactly.
She's like, I have to do something.
So Galus, the look on Galus's face, OMG, tears. And then comes in Jamie. And that, of course, saves Claire. But this is what... So basically, you know, it would have been interesting. I mean, I guess if Jamie didn't come, they both would have died. But when Galus sees Claire, when Galus sees that Jamie is there, she's like, okay. I think, really quickly, right? She knows Claire will be saved in some way, or like, there's a good chance.
All I can do is create a diversion. Out of here.
I need to create a diversion.
Yeah.
Galus basically takes back the stage. Right now, Claire's has the stage. So Galus takes back the crowd.
It's true, but think back to that moment when Ned says Claire has something to say. Mm-hmm. And they show Claire, and they show Galus's face, and Galus's face is like, ugh, just do it. I'm going to die. This is me dying right now. Get it done. And then when Claire says, I have nothing to say, Galus is like, what? And then they pull Claire away to flog her, and Galus is like, damn it, I can't do nothing. I have to do something. And she's just like, I'm going to die anyway.
But she doesn't make that decision. But she can't change the fact that Claire was being whipped.
No,
and
she couldn't but when have she say, saw she Jamie show up,
that's
she's
what
like,
I'm going to say. That's what you didn't say the first time.
No, but when she sees Jamie, she's like, there's a chance that what I do here can make a difference.
Exactly.
Not only, it can't save me. Nothing literally can save me. All I can do as a person is perhaps
but
save
we may
her.
Get a hint later on. I don't know if you caught it or not. We'll get to the end. You'll
it's
see.
In the book.
No, it's in here.
Okay.
So Galus takes back the stage. She admits to being a witch. Claire, in the middle of being whipped, yells, Galus, no! That was so hard to watch. The pain and the emotion. Because she knows that Galus is signing her own death warrant. Galus is already dead. But she knows that she's absolutely signing her own death warrant now and precipitating it. I can just imagine people being put on trial hundreds of years ago. The hysteria, the mob mentality, etc. She totally saves her. She shows her devil's mark, her vaccination scar.
She jumped back into that point. She was prepared to do that from the moment they left that antechamber.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So when she
walked back out, that wouldn't have saved Claire.
Not at that moment. It would have if Claire had stepped up and denounced her.
That's not what I mean.
But when she made that choice to not do it, she was like, I already made this decision.
The funny let's thing is, through. I doubt, because she knew at this point, she believes that she knows.
She said, let's go to the effing barbecue.
She believes that she knows Claire is also a traveler, correct? At this point.
She did, because she literally went around that grate and she said it was all for nothing. She's like, you are not even here on purpose.
Stay with me. So she knows, we believe that she knows or believes that Claire is a traveler. And that she was willing to at least try and help get Claire off and, like, just do it, right? Just do it.
She wouldn't have even shown her, quote-unquote, devil's mark.
No, because if she hadn't
known that Claire was a traveler.
That's not what I mean.
Okay.
If Claire had thrown her under the bus, as she was expecting, right?
As she told her to.
As she was expecting.
Okay.
I argue that she would not have shown her devil's mark. Because if for some reason they had looked at Claire and seen the same one, it could have condemned them both. There would have been no reason to put herself extra out there.
She didn't know when Claire was from. She didn't know that she still had a vaccination mark.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, she didn't know going in what she was defusing Claire from having in that moment. So she didn't know that Jamie would have known that Claire had that vaccination mark.
Well, it's not about Jamie. It's about what I'm saying is,
she didn't know that she could have been incriminating Claire along with her own self.
But she could have. I think my guess is that she would have thought Claire was, if not from the same place, then around the same time. Because I don't think she would have thought Claire was from the past.
The only thing Claire stated was that she was not of that time period. And exactly. It was an accident. She was not there on purpose. And when we get to Gaylis's face and she says, it was all for nothing.
Yeah.
Like, she was just like, you aren't even here on purpose. And it was literally all for nothing. It's the first time where I was just like, ugh, I felt her desperation in that moment of like, I have wasted my life.
So once Gaylis shows her devil's mark, her vaccination scar, Claire now knew for certain that she was a traveler as well. And I wrote, OMG, in all caps, OMG, OMG, it has begun. Technically, time travel for the story, for the viewer, happened in the first episode, right? That's when everything began. Except now, as soon as you find another traveler, even though she's about to be burned as a witch, the moment we find another traveler, this story, I could imagine for the viewer, is rocking your world.
For the non-book viewer.
That's why I say viewer. Okay. Yeah, I mean pure viewer, or viewer who hasn't read. That stripping and causing attention to herself when she takes off her gown, and that scream, that is almost exactly what I had in mind in the book when she does the spin. That's okay. The scream that she does.
Okay, this is going to give you... This is what happened to me last night. I was watching the show, trying to take notes for our episode today.
Before I gave up.
But what happened is that my daughter went to sleep, and she came out, and she was not asleep, and she was like, Mommy, I'm not asleep. So I took my tablet and my headphones, and I went in, and I kind of hung out with her in the dark room, hoping she would fall asleep. And today, she told me, when I was trying to catch back up and catch up with the episode, she was like, she mentioned that she remembered me watching this episode last night, and there was screaming and everyone carrying a woman out. And I was like, what are you talking about? Because I had fallen asleep during that time period. And I went and watched it again today. And that scream that she gave was so haunting.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had that almost like Christ-like carrying of her. Mosh pit, like crowd surfing, where they carried her out and they'd covered her. But as I rewatched it again today, I was like, oh my God, how much of this episode did she see while I fell asleep in the dark?
Don't do that again.
I won't.
So that scream, and they're carrying her.
It's awful.
She did this all for Claire. And the last thing we hear, this is what I was telling you about, you get a little bit of a hint that something may be not what you're thinking is, and I'm not going to say what that is or isn't. The last thing we hear from the judge as she is carried out, ostensibly to be taken to the stake, is he's yelling over the people's heads, she's with child!
I thought that was Ned.
Nope, it was one of the judges.
I thought it was Ned.
And I just wrote, keep that in mind. Tony Graffia and the director, Mike Barker, did an amazing job with this episode. It gets me every time.
Now, her mention of 1968 was not the same as the books.
No. Well, she never mentioned it in the book.
She didn't, and that was something that was relayed to her later in the novel from Dougal, actually.
But I still thought it was not from the books, but I thought it was still moving, and I still got chill bumps from it.
Now, Jamie and Claire, we haven't said much about Jamie. Jamie and Claire escape while Gellis is taken away. They get to a safe spot, and Jamie confronts her about her scar, and she spills the beans. There are no more secrets between them.
Well, before that, in the books, during the witch trial scene, when Gellis is doing her, I'm a witch, I've killed all these people, and I did all this, and I'm a bad person, she spins around, she rips her clothes off, and she looks at Claire for that split second, my gosh. And she mouths
Stop it.
The word,
run.
Run.
That is chilling to me.
It is. And in the episode, they didn't quite do that. She audibly said to Claire, run, mm-hmm. which I thought still worked for this episode, considering the other changes they've made.
Yeah.
But I kind of wish they'd left it, where it was this like personal one-on-one moment
that
was shared
out.
Just between the two of them. Like, I'm doing this for you. Get out.
Stop it. You just
don't make, do not
nose,
make my
nose,
sacrifice mean nothing.
A nose prick now.
Nose prick? Like, is your nose running?
No, that's silly.
You
no,
said
a
nose
tear prick
okay.
is like, you know, you feel when you're about to cry, you feel like something in your nose?
Nope.
I always do.
Just
so I thought it was an interesting choice to have her tell him this without going into the hysterical laughter in the book. Hear her reaction to his question, are you,
oh my
you
God.
Gotta tell me this.
That was so
are
funny.
You a witch? And she's like, are you serious?
That was so funny to me, though.
It was funny, but I would have lost my shizzle, and I would have laughed like a banshee, too, if she had started laughing. I would have loved it. It may have been a little bit too much cackling for one episode if they kept it.
It was so, this whole scene was so well done between Sam and Katrina.
Oh my gosh.
It was so well done. Like, Sam in this scene was like spot on. Spot on his reaction to her telling him. And they led into that moment that actually happened in the honeymoon. In the wedding bedchamber, when he was like, let there be nothing between us but honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, okay.
There's room for secrets but
right.
no lies.
And they don't say that mm-hmm. in the honeymoon, in the wedding episode, but they said it here.
Not verbatim, but the same thing.
No, but that's where they brought that
yes.
moment in that was actually in the books in the wedding scene. And that, they had that moment, so it was leading into her basically spilling
confession,
her guts
yeah.
of nonsense that he should never believe, but mm-hmm. he did because he is a smart and brilliant man.
And he's educated, yeah.
And educated, and such a well-played moment by Sam Heughan. I loved that whole scene. I loved him saying, you know, we have nothing but honesty between us, let's be honest. And she's like, okay. And then he's like, all right, are you a witch? And she's like, are you serious right now? And he's like, well, I have to tell you, you told me that this, that, and the other, and I saw that mark on Gellis, and I've seen it on you,
yeah.
but I've been ignoring it. But now that she's called it a devil's mark, is it?
Yeah,
and
what's
she's
going on?
Just like, the only thing I'm going to say about this book point of view, I thought it was a little better written in the book. I thought her description of it
in
was
the book
a,
or
in
than
the
book.
Book. In the book,
okay.
I thought it was a little better written. He's the, are you a witch? And she didn't in the book say, are you serious? She's like, you must think I should be. You must think I would be.
It would be
when
easier if I were.
Right. If I explain this to you,
and then
how
she
can
starts
you believe,
going hysterical.
If I explain this to you, how could you believe anything
exactly.
other than this?
And then she, yeah, agreed.
And she explains, I could walk through a room full of dying people mm-hmm. and never catch an illness because I have these vaccinations. And she goes into it. And they touched on all of it. And
yeah.
It was still
beautiful.
As a non-book reader, it was still really well written. But I think Diana Gabaldon got this one a little closer to home for me.
Well, she did write the original.
I know. I'm just saying. I just
for
think
the scene.
I think it was so well written. I think it was so well written originally, they almost didn't need to reword it. But it still worked.
The look on her face when she says she knows what's going to happen to the Scots is so sad. I wrote, Jamie is slightly remote. He says he believes her. And then after he's not remote. You can see, obviously, he's doing a lot of thinking. And then once, and he believes her, he then berates himself for having beaten her. And I wrote, Sam looks more like Jamie here than in any other scene in any other episode. The hair falling over his face.
Screw
his
hair.
The slightly slanted eyes.
All of that. He played this moment so brilliantly
perfectly.
That you could just tell how gutted he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was just like, so you, when I left you in that glade and you ran away, you were actually trying to get back to your own time and your actual husband, who's still alive and not dead. And she's like, basically, yep. And he's like, and I beat you for it. And then he has that moment and he's like, I can't possibly explain to you how sorry I am that I did that. And she's just like,
there's no way you could have known.
No. No. Which wasn't about to tell you. I think the non-book readers who are just seeing the TV series and were a little bit offended by the spanking episode should take that into consideration. Because, and this is what the book readers all along have known, is that the reason we let it slide that he spanked his wife was the fact that she let it slide. And we let a lot of things go that Claire lets go because we are Claire when we read the books. That's the only perspective we have, at least in the first book, 100%, is that it's, we're there with Claire. And when she says it wasn't, not that it wasn't a big deal, and I'm sure it hurt and she didn't get to sit for a while, but when she let it go, we let it go. So to have that moment happen in the series, I think, is big.
He talks of Lallybroch, but becomes aware that she is beginning to slip away.
I don't know that he's aware. I think that he is making that decision that he can't make it for her, and he needs her to make that decision because he could not forgive himself to have made that decision for her.
Yes, but that's what I'm trying to say, is he does not become, like, remote and, like, you know, leave her or anything, but he can tell that she is kind of slipping back into herself. And he's like, you know what? I can't do this. She needs to at least have that opportunity to make that decision.
She needs to choose.
Exactly.
Before she chooses, though, can we talk about the fact that every time they show a scene of him and her riding on a horse together, and they do it just right, it looks like he has ridiculously long hair, and it looks like he's got,
I didn't notice.
When his position just right, Katrina's hair shows up right behind Sam's head, so it looks like he has this, like, crazy, wavy, like, wavy hair. It's really funny. Go back and watch it
again. You can tell that night by the fire, when he pleasures her, that he has made his decision.
Okay, can we just talk about that for a second, though? Sure. And what I wrote was, does he ever just let her sleep? Because
first the cookie jar.
Not that alternative activities aren't entertaining and nice, but sleeping is pretty good, too, and he doesn't seem to let her do that.
Well, he's about to say goodbye to her, so he expects. So he just needs to see. He wants to see her face, or have her face again emblazoned in his mind and memory.
I get it. At the same time, I also enjoy sleeping. And to be constantly awoken. Every time we see her sleeping in this series, he's waking her up. For a good reason, but still waking her up.
So he wants to look at her face like it's one more time to burn her into his memory.
He doesn't look at her face. He wants to watch her.
I know that.
And if it was not Jamie, could we just say how creepy that would have been from anyone else?
The next morning, they've made their way to their destination.
He's like, no. He goes, we're home. He's like, we're here. Go look at it. And she thinks she's going to walk up this mountain and find Lallybroch because mm-hmm. she's dumb and doesn't recognize where she is. Even though she's been here at least three times now.
That's funny.
And she walks up
because
the ridge.
She's dumb.
Right. She walks up the ridge and she's like,
what?
What the shit?
Must be like a different direction because, yeah. I'm a little surprised she didn't notice something.
She's been there at least three times.
The original, when she wakes up, and then when she revisits?
No. The original, she wakes up. Okay, then four times. The original. The original, she wakes up. She's there with Wee Willie and runs across the long field to get to it.
Oh, that's
and then
third.
Now
okay.
Presently, when
fair
she's
enough.
Like, what?
So then she says, So then he says, you're ready to go home. They're at the stones.
And she assumes it's Lallybroch.
Yes. And they're at the stones.
Because she's dumb.
And their theme is all over the place. All over the place is their theme. And, oh, sorry. Wow, back up. Okay. He says, you're ready to go home then. And they're at the stones. So this It was pretty similar. It was pretty, other than, we know that the whole stone thing is different than the book, because in the stone, it's a cleft. In the book, it's a cleft. Here, it's just a big stone in the middle that she touches and then gets whizzed away. But otherwise, other than the formation of a stone, the actual scene is pretty similar to the book, right? He pulls her back. But in the book, he says he sees her, like, disappearing, or does it...
He can see her leaving, like...
Yeah, somehow.
And Diana doesn't indicate what it looks like to the outsider, yes, to see them passing it. I don't know if she becomes less...
of herself?
As she becomes a solid, maybe, as she begins to travel, but that part of it, I thought, was pretty true to the book, because we don't know what happened, and clearly Jamie saw something happening, and he stopped it happening. And you could hear it. You could hear the stones starting to scream. The one... I missed the Crofter's cottage.
Oh, I know.
I missed that they were like... He's like, I'm going to be at this Crofter's cottage through nightfall just to make sure you make it and you're safe. And he kind of did that. He's like, I'm going to go back to camp. So wherever they camped the night before, I imagine, is where he went back to. There was a lot of little intimate moments in the book that followed this scene of the stones. I enjoyed the lead up to her, like, looking like she was going to the stones. But in the book, what was so funny, not funny, but so moving for me, was that she was like, I started walking toward the stones.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept walking.
And I found
out. And before I knew where I was down the hill at the Crofter's cottage, mm-hmm, and climbing in the bed with Jamie.
Speaking of that, absolutely right. But that made me think, in the episode, it could be the coming episode, on dark, but it's nowhere near dark.
No. The episode indicates that it made it seem like she walked to that stone.
Yes, yes.
Not through it, past it, whatever, but she walked to it, and then all of a sudden, it shows Jamie at the camp, and she says, on your feet, soldier, which was an echo back to the first episode.
Yeah.
When she tells him to get on his feet. Mm-hmm. I honestly missed from the book when she basically wakes him up to do him. And he's like, I thought you weren't real.
Aww.
He had that moment where he
had a little tear on his face. You could see it.
He did.
But it wasn't...
But they
It
totally,
was convincing,
she,
but it,
she
he
went
wasn't...
down the hill, went to the Crofter's cottage, and then, like, they did it. And he's like, he woke up. He kind of deserved it. He's constantly in this series waking her up to pleasure her. He earned it. She should have woken him up to pleasure him in this moment. That should have been how he came to that realization. However, it worked. It did echo back to the first episode when she said, on your feet, soldier, mm-hmm, after she nursed him.
And she didn't actually nurse him. She helped him. I mean, she nurses him later.
She did. It was after he'd fallen off the horse. And she like,
nurses him later.
In After they're regard, married. You dirty, dirty whore.
I'm not the one who said, Summer, don't call me those names.
Darling.
So, I agree. It wasn't exactly like the books, but again, it doesn't have to be. And there's, from the moment, I mean, I think it's at the stones too, but when she is down, I wrote, the theme, their theme is all over the end of this episode. And then when she says, on your feet, soldier, I wrote, great choice. I mean, if you're not going to do, like, where she goes to wake him up and all that.
No, I mean, if we are strictly episodes and TV series, it was good. It was perfect.
And as just before the episode ends, we know that she's made her choice. And
she says,
again,
take me, Lallybroch.
Exactly. And I love, again.
Didn't she say Lallybroch?
I have no idea. I love the end. I love the music at the end.
Of course you do.
And so this was probably my favorite episode thus far. I mean, it doesn't surprise me because of the witch sequence, Witch Trial. Which, again, I knew it would be hysteria and mob mentality, and it was. It was great. It was a great build-up, very passionate. But I think the star of this episode was Lotte Verbeek, her character of Galus, and as you said, her world crumbling down for however much it would do for her, which, you know, she's human, so it is big and bad for her. The way she builds, she loses what she believes in, or what she thinks she believes. What she believes in, besides Scotland, is Dougal and their cause. And it was amazing, and it was quite frankly, an honor to be able to watch this performance. Because, as you said, it wasn't just one time. I thought it was, looking back, I had written one time. She did it at least two times, maybe not three or four, but there were a few times where she owns it. You can see, she gives good face. I mean, she, crazy, just such emotion, and some of the stills that I'll share in our show notes from this episode.
I think just amazing. Clearly lots of her beak, like, earned her paycheck in this episode.
Oh my gosh.
Like, if she just kind of, like, was, you know, phoning it in for the rest of the season, like, she literally earned her entire paycheck in this episode. But this was just a really well-written episode from front to back.
Oh my gosh.
I think I was telling somebody about it today. I said, you know, somebody who's watching it, that this was like a penultimate episode, like a really mm-hmm. big moment in this episode. Her choosing to stay,
mm-hmm.
her Jamie giving her that choice of go home, go yes. to your husband, go to what you know, and her yes. going, that isn't important to me anymore. You are my home. Yes. You are.
Going back to, absolutely. Now, going back to what you just said, in the book, I know we're not in the book, but looking at the book and Diana, and we can talk about it. In our interview with Diana, she gives all the shapes of her books thus far. The shape of this was three triangles. So it was basically three peaks. This was the first peak, if I'm not mistaken. This, we can't talk about what the other ones are, but
they're coming.
But the wedding actually wasn't really a peak because it was part of growing their story together. But this is, I believe, the first triangle, the first peak, and then the other ones
that are
we
coming.
Can't say. Which, but
go
from
read
what,
the book.
From what we understand, are definitely going by episode titles are definitely kept. So. Even though it may not have been, you know, the TV medium is completely different than from books. We get it. But as far as the drama is, there have been drama all throughout, but those three peaks are still there.
I would not
disagree. And one of those peaks, without saying any detail or any content, one of those peaks is from the book in a chapter called To Ransom a Man's Soul. That's the name of an episode. And it's written by Tony Graffia.
Well, I mean, I think that it's
she's one of my
capable hands. I mean,
they're
team
all
of writers,
capable.
The
but
team
she,
of writers they have, man.
Ugh.
But I think that
but she's
I think what's
broken
so
my heart.
Brilliant about the way they're using their writers is it's like they're using them in the appropriate episodes that they're best suited for. I mean, if you look at it, they use Tony Graffia for the episodes that need to evoke a specific feeling or emotion in one way, and then use Matt B. Roberts for the ones that need to do a specific thing. I think they are brilliantly using their writers, mm-hmm. brilliantly using directors. I mean,
I want to find out more about this director as well. And I definitely want to find out more about Tony. But, oh my goodness, yeah. That's just, stay tuned because, wow.
So that was episode 111.
You are listening to us here, so hopefully you have enjoyed our episode, but we hope that you guys fell in love with Lotte Verbeek, if you weren't already in love with her, and we really want to hear from you guys. What did you think about this episode? Was it your favorite? What was the highlight? Was it Galus? Was it Claire? Was it Jamie? Was it the Stones? Was it the Witch Trial? Was it the Thieves' Hole? Was it Ned? Was it Leary? Was it Jeannie?
Dude, if it
Let
was Leary...
Let us know.
I hate you right now. It can't be Leary.
Unless you're Nell Hudson's mother.
It's true. And I mean, it's a credit to Nell Hudson that I wanted to punch her in her little snarky face. Like she said, she's going to dance on Claire's grave. She can just die. Okay. So what I've seen on IMDb is that next episode is indeed entitled Lallybroch, as it should be.
Oh my goodness. And yeah, I really, really look forward to that.
It's going to be good, y'all.
It's going to be
so good.
It has, I mean, okay, yeah. There's not much more to say because we can't give anything away.
I mean,
so
we shouldn't. It's gone
thank
on long
you.
Enough.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.